The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com.
It's Thursday, September 19th, less than 7 weeks until Election Day. It's 2:39 in the afternoon, and things will have changed by the time you listen to this. We're the Mincing Rascals. I'm today's guest host, Eric Zorn, former Tribune columnist and now the editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, an award-worthy newsletter you can subscribe to for free by emailing me at ericzorn@gmail.com.
I'm Marge Halperin. I draw on a couple of decades of experience in government reform positions as a journalist, as a communications consultant, doing whatever I can, wherever I can to challenge authority.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now writing the Chicago History website, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
And I'm Brandon Pope, Emmy-winning host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on WCIU, and a contributor to many other platforms.
Emmy-winning? I didn't know about that. When did that happen?
I got my first Emmy win last year. I got my fifth nomination last week. So,
congratulations.
Man, you're honored. I did not know. I hadn't heard that in your intro before. I would use that. I would introduce myself like that. We had parties, man. I would say, hi.
I'm sorry. In the intros, but I don't know why. Today, just like, yo, let me just drop that in real quick.
Yeah, just drop it in. We're not going to notice. Okay, you guys. Regular host John Williams is off at an undisclosed location. I'm in charge this week. Please, I'm asking the panel, don't treat me like a substitute teacher. Show a little respect. We're going to talk about the presidential election today and also former Chicago Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr.'s bid for a pardon for having committed all those crimes years ago. Actor Jesse Smollett's appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court to have his hate crime hoax conviction overturned. But let's start with the ongoing misadventures of Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson. He's having some terrible, horrible, no good, very bad days a year and a half into his first term. Here's a quick review. His progressive invest in people agenda has been stymied by his inability to locate significant sources of new revenue to plug this year's $223 million budget gap, let alone the $982 million budget shortfall for next year. Chicago Public Schools say they can close a $505 million budget gap with district level cuts and efficiencies, but they don't have a contract yet with the Chicago Teachers Union. Their salary and other demands stand to increase the deficit to $3 billion in the next fiscal year. The union is blithely suggesting the city try again to raise money in the ways that have already failed. Mayor Johnson's failed to install his pick for zoning committee chair over council objections. He's under fire from progressives for how police frog marched two fired staffers out of City Hall. And he's sticking by his new head of governmental affairs, Kennedy Bartley, even though she called police slave catchers and effing pigs in online interviews, and is such a polarizing figure that key staffers from the Intergovernmental Affairs Department, including the highly valued, widely respected Deputy Mayor of Intergovernmental Affairs, Sydney Holman, they all quit rather than report to Bartley. And in Wednesday's Tribune Southwest Side, Alder Sylvia Tavares, former Democratic state rep, wrote an op-ed tearing the hide off Mayor Johnson. She wrote, "Time after time, Johnson has shown the guiding concept of his politics and governing is not one of addition, but of subtraction and division. Missteps and miscalculations are shaping up to be the defining feature of his tenure. However, unlike school, it is not the student that failed when he gets the bad grade. When you're the mayor, it's the city. Leadership sets the course, whether toward prosperity or hardship." And now there's the ShotSpotter controversy, which is breaking all around us as we record this. Johnson campaigned on a promise to get rid of this controversial $10 million a year gunfire detection system. Police and most of the alders in the wards where ShotSpotter's installed want to keep it. The new study from the U of C Crime Lab says it saves in the neighborhood of 85 lives a year by getting first responders to gunshot victims more quickly. It looks like the council doesn't have the power to prevent Johnson from flipping the switch. And ShotSpotter has just today offered a 48% discount to try to keep the system running. So touch on any or all of these topics, Marge Halperin, when answering the basic question, what, if anything, can be done to save this mayor and put him on the path toward reelection?
The number one thing he needs to do is what we've talked about now for like a year and a half. He needs to improve his communications. He needs to have more clarity about his goals, his objectives, his successes, and his compromises when they come along. ShotSpotters, whole separate topic. I spent a lot of time digging up research today. I don't know why we would keep this. It has even a side problem of delaying 911 calls in general because it ties up so many police officers chasing down false positives, if you will. So something like 90% of these call of these alerts from ShotSpotter are false. There was that incident last February when police stormed in the backyard of a 14-year-old shooting off fireworks, and one of the officers pulled his gun. Luckily, he missed the kid who ran in the house. You know, if we spent half of the money we have on ShotSpotter on better police training and de-escalation strategies in particular, I think we would save plenty of lives and reduce crime, which right now ShotSpotter doesn't do. But I want to throw out another hypothesis, and I'm not saying I think this is a good idea, but I'm beginning to think, rather than as the editorial you mentioned suggests, that politics is addition, you have to bring everybody along. If Johnson truly wants to transform the city in the ways that he said during his campaign, he's not going to bring along half the city council. Maybe he's doing what we've seen on a national platform, say, by the president-elected in 2016, where, damn the torpedoes, this is my vision for the city, and I'm going to change it in that direction as fast and effectively as I can. And then everyone will see what a great idea it is, and they'll think I'm a great mayor. I'm starting to think that's kind of his philosophy. He's not compromising because he doesn't believe in the points of view or issue positions that at least half of the city council endorses. I'm not saying this is effective, but this is my current read on Johnson. He's not trying to do it like Rahm Emanuel or Rich Daley did it, or Lori Lightfoot, which wasn't very successful either. You know, he's got his own way. He's stacking the deck with the people that he knows stand as far left as he does, just saying, watch me.
But I thought that the whole rap on Emanuel and Daley was they were all my way or the highway guys. Brandon, what do you think?
It's a fascinating topic. I just wrapped an interview this week with Superintendent Larry Snelling, who has made it clear he wants to keep ShotSpotter. He believes that it helps officers in their response time. I asked him, what will you do if it's gone? He says that he believes his officers will find a way to respond and believes there will be other technology they may be able to utilize to make up for the loss of ShotSpotter there. And the thing with the numbers you put out there, Eric, from the crime lab, I've seen lots of studies just like that. I've also seen some studies that show the opposite, that say that ShotSpotter actually slowed down police response times. It's almost like polls with these elections. Probably could find a study to kind of confirm whatever you want to confirm with this one with ShotSpotter. But what Johnson, I think, has to do, kind of repeating what Mark said, communication. Why do you want to remove ShotSpotter so much? I think you got to explain more deeply than just it's not working. You got to explain to folks why it's not, because the truth of the matter is I trust the polling that says that a lot of people in the communities want to keep ShotSpotter. I trust the people I talk to on the ground who say they want to keep ShotSpotter. There's a man out here. He's a prominent community organizer and community service guy in the South Shore neighborhood, Levante Stewart. Amazing man, runs Lost Boys, Inc. Recently lost his son to gun violence. And he has been pleading to the mayor and saying he believes that ShotSpotter is a tool that can help combat violence in neighborhoods like South Shore. And he feels like he's not being listened to. So I think there's got to be better communication from City Hall and from the fifth floor as to why exactly Mayor Johnson believes ShotSpotter has to go. And it's got to go beyond just he's fulfilling a campaign promise. We got to actually understand what numbers and data he's seeing to show that ShotSpotter isn't effective or is having an adverse effect on people.
Yeah, you know, it's possible that some of these studies, they seem to be contradictory, but they may be, they're both true. It may be that ShotSpotter alerts slow down responses to conventional 911 calls. At the same time, it may also be true that it does get ambulances and police officers to gunshot victims faster and save lives, which is why, I mean, in some ways I'm kind of agnostic. I'm in the Northwest side. We don't even have ShotSpotter up here. I kind of rely on the people on the ground like you, Brandon, or the alders who represent them, or the police who are in charge of trying to keep these numbers down. But I can see where, you know, you could have these various studies and they don't necessarily contradict each other, but they don't necessarily jibe. Kate, what are your thoughts on ShotSpotter and the mayor's presentation in general?
Yeah, I'd say by definition, anyone who says they know whether it works or not, they don't know. There are the conflicting studies. The study about whether or not it keeps police from responding to other 911 calls, that was they were saying that supposedly 9% slower in the response, I think, was what they said. So, but they, even the University of Chicago Crime Lab, when it came up with the statistics of approximately 85 lives saved by it this past year, they admit that the numbers are very tenuous. The one number I saw that didn't seem completely tenuous was the Chicago police statistics that only got kept since this past January, after the city council insisted that they start being kept in order to take a better look at whether or not to continue with ShotSpotter. And that was out of about 30,000 ShotSpotter events, 73% of those had no corresponding 911 call. And that does seem to be a recurring thing that everyone agrees on, that because shootings are so frequent in the districts where they have ShotSpotter, very few people bother to call 911 anymore. In fact, early on in this, Alderman Peter Chico from the 10th Ward, who used to be a police officer, he specifically said that a friend of his was shot in the Taylor Street neighborhood and was laying on the ground for about an hour before being found because no one called 911. And I don't know why shot that. Was that before ShotSpotter? No, but somehow ShotSpotter didn't get it to him either. Oh, you know what? Maybe they don't have ShotSpotter over there. In any case, it's very conflicting. So we don't really know. So I don't understand why Mayor Johnson does not want to collaborate, as he likes to say, and be democratic about deciding whether or not to keep it, because the overwhelming number of aldermen and wards who have it, that's 14 out of 17, want to keep it. The survey showed that it's very popular among the public as well. And until Mayor Johnson can persuade more people to his viewpoint, it seems to me he does have a responsibility to collaborate with the council. But unfortunately, I agree with you, Marge. He has shown really, unfortunately, kind of nonstop that he's not really interested in doing that kind of co-opting of people who don't agree with him and making deals and getting more people in on his stuff. He just isn't interested in that. And this is a very good example of that, the way he's been opposing the alderman nonstop through all this. And in fact, did not consult them before he canceled it.
What really puzzles me is there's a great story to tell here if you want to oppose ShotSpotter. There are plenty of statistics, and each side will pull out the one that sort of suits them. But this idea that you raised, Kate, about not having the corresponding 911 calls, well, if 80 to 85% of the ShotSpotter alerts are false positives, there's no 911 call because people in the neighborhoods know the difference between a gunshot and fireworks. So they're not calling.
We don't actually know that they're all false positives.
We don't know how these two numbers go together. Yeah. But when you pick one or the other, you're not telling a complete story. But there is a story to be told about the number of cities across the country who are dumping ShotSpotter, not just because they made a campaign promise, as you said, Eric. They're giving the reasons, and there are reasons why you could do it. 7% of the ShotSpotter alerts in Chicago between 21 and 24 found a shooting victim. That's pretty small. If the rest of them turn up nothing, what should police be doing instead of chasing down these false alerts? It's not the number. Yeah, show us why it's not.
Well, I think
take your point, Marge. Yeah, we don't actually know how many of them are false alarms, or there are cases where, of course, people leave once the police arrive if they've been shooting. And then there's nothing to find, right? Which to some extent could be a good thing. If people didn't expect the police to come at the sound of gunshots, they could just stand around and shoot all day, maybe. That wouldn't be good either.
Well, but the problem with that is that they don't close the book on the crime. So they're not catching people because they right. have this opportunity to escape. It's not right. leading to a reduction in crime. If it's saving lives, which is Eric's point, we need to be sure that that statistic is not wholly isolated, that it's based on comparisons, apples to apples. Yeah. You know, if you think you're saving a life on Taylor Street that otherwise would have been lost, is it, you know, that block being compared to the same block or the difference across the street? Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole lot of factors. When you just pull out these numbers, it's cavalier and it's not helpful to the conversation. The last thing I'll say on this, but I do also want to say, not a popularity poll. Yeah. We're not electing ShotSpotter here. I really believe there's so much science. Why isn't the mayor leading the way on a scientific conversation that helps us understand?
I would say because there is so many conflicting numbers, no one really knows which numbers are correct. And because we don't know which numbers are correct, at this point, should we not be going with the majority of the democratically elected leaders until we have more information? I think the best evidence that Mayor Johnson has completely mishandled this is that he canceled it without speaking to anybody and without having a plan in place first for how to transition and what would take its place. Now, it's been like 6 months even since he canceled it, and he still doesn't have a transition in place. He still doesn't have a new plan in place. They're beginning that process. Why wouldn't you begin that process and finish that process before you cancel the contract?
Well, Jake Sheridan of the Tribune reported today that he contacted ShotSpotter and asked, what's this transition period supposed to be like? And they said, what the transition period? We're turning it off on Sunday. And the other thing, of course, is that Mayor Johnson, when faced with this, he could have pulled the plug on it months ago, but he decided to keep it through the summer. You had to ask, well, why did you keep it if it's useless? So the thing about this conversation we're having is that it all may be moot by the time anyone hears this except us, because they're going to be voting on it on the council. And my prediction is that the council will be unable to take the authority away from the mayor, and that we will lose ShotSpotter, and then we'll have another experiment here. Just as a political matter, it does seem like Johnson did not communicate well with this. He called the walkie-talkies on a poll on Monday at a news conference, which is not also very accurate. So it'll be interesting politically what happens. Also, I want to correct myself. It's Silvana Tavares, not Sylvia. I misread that.
The council actually has already voted on this. They voted 34 to, I think, 12 to require Mayor Johnson to bring it to them before it gets canceled, even though he had already canceled it. Now, his response to that was, you have no authority over me signing contracts, so I'm not even going to pay attention to this ordinance that was just, in fact, legally passed. He's just ignoring it. So now they want to just, you know, for listeners, they are possibly today while we're speaking are going to potentially take out of committee and vote on a new ordinance giving authority to Superintendent Snelling to sign the contract. If they can't do that, they're going to attempt to have a special city council meeting to let the procurement office person sign a contract. And I agree with you, Eric, that I don't think any of that's going to amount to anything. If Johnson will not follow a legally passed ordinance to bring it to the council to ask their permission to cancel the contract, it seems very unlikely that Larry Snelling is going to go sign that contract, or the procurement officer. No one else is going to sign that contract. The whole point, though, is how it shows his absolute disregard for getting anybody else on board with him. When 34 to 12 aldermen have asked you to bring this to us, and you decide you're just not going to ignore it, it just shows you his regard for the council. And his point all along on this and on, for instance, Bring Chicago Home is that he was elected by the city of Chicago to do something on this platform, so he's going to do it. But, you know, obviously he was elected without any kind of real mandate. He only won by 4%, and that was with about a quarter of the city's registered voters voting, even. So an incredibly slim number of people voted more for him than for Paul Vallis. But you're also disregarding the 34 aldermen who were also democratically elected and represent the majority of the city. So I'm not seeing democracy in action here.
It may be a legally passed ordinance. It is a legally passed ordinance, but it is perhaps illegally an attempt to take away the mayor's contracting authority. They could pass that through a legal process of the way the city council works, but that doesn't mean that the ordinance itself is legal. And I think Eric said earlier, it's probably would fail in courts. I don't think they can take that contracting authority away from the mayor.
You're probably right. And that's probably why they didn't take him to court over at Marge. My point is that it shows the vast majority of the council wants to discuss this and take it further. And he is not willing to work with them.
The Sun-Times had a good term for this. They called it parliamentary ping pong is going on in city council. And we're learning a lot about the whole process. Brandon, you got the last word on this topic.
Well, yeah, I think this is another litmus test of the Johnson administration and Johnson's mayorship. I think we've seen a few of those just over the past few weeks. We saw the situation with the movement in his office with different positions, and someone got caught on a podcast saying some wild things. It's just like one thing after another. We're going to have to see, do voters have short memories? Do they have long memories? And how much does this stuff actually matter to them? I want to see some reliable polling on what exactly the people of Chicago think about all these things happening with Brandon Johnson's term, the controversies, the ShotSpotter debate. How do they actually feel about ShotSpotter? There is a poll out there that was commissioned by ShotSpotter folks that shows the majority of Chicagoans that were polled want to keep ShotSpotter. I think they had 70% as the number, but got to look at the source. Got to look at who they actually talk to, where they go. So really want to see what the scope is on where people are with this, because it varies. I mean, I've talked to people who do want ShotSpotter gone. I've talked to people that don't, and you can't really base it off of demographics too much either. I've talked to Black people that want to see it gone and Black folk who want to see it kept. Latinos that want to see it gone, Latinos that want to keep it kept. And so at the end of the day, I wonder if we're going to have, if there's going to be short memories or long memories, and how these things are going to impact Brandon Johnson as he tries to seek a second term long term. Because right now, with the communication troubles, it's looking tough.
Change is hard. And he is a very different kind of mayor with a very different set of values and principles and goals than any mayor we've had in recent memory. And there's an old guard that's fighting back internally and on the city council. He's taking a gamble, I think, on this new direction. Is it going to work for him? I can't predict. But I'm seeing him increasingly doubling down on doing things the way he intends to do them, and then being judged on it when it's time for re-election. This thing about Kennedy Bartley, you know, her comments were several years ago as an independent activist, and they were not diplomatic. And I wish, you know, perhaps they could have been tempered a little, but that was her speaking for herself. She doesn't say that in her current role. And the people who left are from the old guard. We don't know how well she would do with the council. We don't think the mayor is doing that well so far in his intergovernmental affairs. Maybe she could improve it, maybe not. But I think she ought to be judged based on her work in the job. And overall, so will Johnson. The poll I'd like to see, Brandon, is like we do nationally. City going right track, wrong track. But he's not making his case, and I don't think he would do very well in such a poll unless he amps up his explanations for what he's doing.
Well, speaking of new beginnings, former U.S. Rep. Jesse Jackson Jr. of Chicago is seeking a presidential pardon. In 2013, he pleaded guilty to illegally using $250,000 in campaign funds for personal use. It's sort of hilarious. The story is looking back on them. They bought airplane tickets, booze and cigars and souvenirs associated with Michael Jackson and Malcolm X and Bruce Lee. And they would use their campaign money to buy bathrobes and underwear and toilet paper, and they went to a trip to Martha's Vineyard and on and on. It was a pretty gross violation of campaign finance laws. At the time of his plea, Jackson released a statement saying, "I fully accept my responsibility for the improper decisions and mistakes I've made." He served 17 months in federal prison. He's been out since the spring of 2015. And now there's a whole set of impressive allies, South Suburban mayors, current and former members of Congress, who want us to forgive and forget. And Laura Washington speculated in Wednesday's Tribune he's doing this so that he can run again for a state or local office, which he now cannot do as a convicted felon under state law. So pardon or no pardon, Kate?
No pardon. I'm all for compassionate release of people out of jail who are super elderly or super sick, have some extremely good reason for a compassionate release. He's not in jail. He's been out for a long time. He is, as Laura Washington noted, he's been filling in on WVON quite a bit. He's just fine. He doesn't need a pardon for any reason other than wanting to run for office. And I think if somebody asked me personally, I would say that felons in general should be allowed to run for office. But I don't think any politicians who have been convicted in their official capacity should ever be allowed to run again. I would draw a really hard line there. I was listening to Hermine Hartman on Lisa Dent. She's going to be publishing a editorial in favor of a Jesse Jackson Jr. pardon today. And her point was, he didn't steal anything. And I think I have to disagree with that. $750,000 taken from your campaign cash to buy things like an autographed Michael Jackson guitar or a couple of stuffed elk heads and the like is that is stealing from the people who donated to your campaign. That absolutely is stealing. It's obviously disabusing the public trust. And I am super disappointed to hear that my own congressperson, Robin Kelly, has written a letter in favor of this pardon.
Brandon, pardon or no pardon?
That's a tough one. If I go off of just what former presidents have done, former President Donald Trump has pardoned Lil Wayne, Dinesh D'Souza for, I believe, embezzlement. You know, the list is long. You look through the list of Trump pardons, it's like it's a who's who of who did what. Barack Obama has some people that have done bank fraud, check fraud, conspiracy to steal bank funds, fraud in connection with electronic mail, all kinds of like money issues that Barack Obama pardoned throughout his two terms in office. So ultimately, I mean, it wouldn't be the most obscene thing if Jesse Jackson Jr. got pardoned by Joe Biden. Should it be on the top of Joe Biden's priorities? Probably not. But I can understand the push. And at the end of the day, there's people that have done worse, far worse, that have gotten pardons. So.
Let's not forget Bill Clinton pardoning Mark Rich and some other fragrant and flagrant felons. Marge, pardon or no pardon?
I say no, at least not right now, because I feel like Jackson has a lot more self-rehabilitation to go. Obviously, he went through a very unstable time, and there were a lot of personal issues involved that clouded his judgment and his health and other things. I'd like to hear him talk more about that if he wants a pardon. He's done his time and we're not owed any further explanation. But if he wants to come back in that way in public service and hold public office and be excused, we should hear more of his introspection. I'm not just saying apologize and beg. Believe me, nothing like that. But at the moment, it's like I did my time, so, you know, let me back in. Isn't enough. It was highly egregious what he and his wife did. And yet they were both good public servants in so many ways. I think he did bring a lot to the state and to his job, as did Sandy as an alder in the city. So, but there's a missing link here. It's not just I'm out of jail now and I've got this VON part-time gig, so I should be pardoned. I want to hear more about how it happened, about how it would not happen again. I just think he's taken a big leap. And the whole pardon thing is, as you all sort of explained, it's got kind of out of hand in the last several presidencies. We didn't used to hear so many of these pardon stories in the, you know, 80s, started up in the 90s maybe. But that's circumventing the legal process and the crime and punishment system, the criminal justice system, for a select and lucky few. And when they're highly placed and have a name and big names to support them, I don't think that's a reason for them to get priority over others who may have good stories to tell, but their names are not as famous.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, a pardon, and I, you know, I got to say that what Brandon said was starting to turn me a little bit on this. I was a pretty strong no for the pardon. And then Brandon points out, well, look at all the people who've gotten pardons, who've committed like pretty bad crimes as well. And I got to think, well, is it, where does Junior fit in on that spectrum? And I got to say that his crime, although he was, as Kate points out, stealing from his donors in a sense. And also, I think there's probably some tax fraud involved there as well. But, part of it is that I have this visceral reaction against this abuse, I would say, of the pardon power. Like, if I think someone should be pardoned if there's really good explanation for what they did, if what they did is no longer considered a crime, like the way Jimmy Carter pardoned the draft of evaders from the Vietnam War, or if there's evidence of innocence that was not found by the court, but it's plausible enough. In this case, he said he accepts responsibility, and now he doesn't want it. He can still run for federal office. There's no bar for a convicted felon to run for Congress, Senate, the presidency if he wants. But I got to say, I've become just in hearing Brandon, I've become a little bit more agnostic on this. But it's a really interesting topic. Speaking though of people who want a do-over. Jussie Smollett and his attorneys were in front of the Illinois Supreme Court Tuesday asking for his conviction to be overturned. If you set the Wayback Machine to January of 2019, remember Smollett called police in the middle of the night to report that he's attacked by a couple of Trump supporters who beat him and doused him with bleach and placed a rope around his neck and so on. And there's a whole long saga about Kim Fox deciding not to prosecute. And it was discovered that this was a hoax that he had perpetrated to get attention for his career, his singing career, his acting career. And so Fox wouldn't prosecute. And they came to an agreement with the state that was, I guess, never exactly formalized, that they would drop the charges if Smollett would forfeit his $10,000 bond money. And he'd already done some community service working at Operation Push. So, and his lawyers have gone to the Supreme Court. He was then convicted, I should say. This story is so long and involved, I'm taking shortcuts here, but Special Prosecutor Dan Webb was appointed. He indicted and then convicted Smollett for this hate crime hoax in court. And before he has served more than a couple of hours in prison, I think, or jail, he was released pending his appeals. And they're now saying that he should not, his second trial, or his trial was invalid because it amounted to double jeopardy, that he had, in a sense, pleaded guilty and been convicted, in a sense, even though there was no admission of guilt or conviction. He's paid his debt to society and could not be retried. An appeals court in Illinois ruled 2-1 that was not a good argument, but the one judge on the appeals court said that, yeah, this is double jeopardy. Kate, do you think Jussie Smollett has a point here?
I so hate to say that I think he does, because he's obviously guilty. I felt he was obviously guilty of perpetrating a hoax the first time I heard about it. I think you must all remember this was allegedly happening at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning during that polar vortex. The polar vortex. Yes. It was like 20 million degrees below zero. And I was supposed to believe that someone who's not even from Chicago and thus used to 20 million degrees below zero was going to go out at 2 or 3 in the morning to, I think, get something from Subway. So it was clear to me from the beginning that he was guilty. And I do think that kind of story just poisons the public discourse so badly that I think it was, in fact, important for it to be clear that he was guilty of it. And yet, when I read the accounts of the attorneys arguing his case before the Illinois Supreme Court, for the first time, I did say to myself, you know, he's got a point, because it is really the office of Kim Fox's fault that this is even going on. But originally, her office sent a representative who had agreed to let him off for forfeiting $10,000 in bond and doing some community service. And, you know, that was clearly a deal that was agreed upon. And it was only the uproar that followed that that eventually resulted in Dan Webb being appointed as the special prosecutor and refiling charges. And I did think it was strange at the time that they could do that, since he had apparently had a prosecution deal. Now, the prosecution's point before the Supreme Court now and before the appeals court was that there was nothing written down, and he had not been deprived of his liberty before, so that they were technically legally allowed to bring the charges again. But his lawyer did make the point they never gave him back that $10,000 bond. And he said something in particular that really rang true with me. He said, and this was Jussie Smollett's attorney saying, prosecutorial agreements that induce a defendant's specific performance, in other words, an agreement so that he agreed to forfeit his money and do the community service, should be enforced irrespective of how unpopular a defendant is in the public eye. In essence, we hearken back to the age-long principle of a deal is a deal. And I have to say, he's kind of right. They didn't write it down. And I think this shows that Kim Fox's office knew that this was not a good deal, that it was kind of an underhanded sort of deal. So they didn't write anything down, but they made a deal, even if they didn't write it down. So if the Supreme Court lets him off, well, obviously, this has been going on for so long. Obviously, he's paid quite a high price for what he did. So I would not be too unhappy if that happened.
Yeah, I have that sense, too, that his career has been derailed by this. He's paid an incredible price already. Brandon, what do you think? If you're on the Illinois Supreme Court, Justice Pope, how do you vote?
Well, you know, Kate's kind of swayed me a little bit. I covered the Jussie Smollett thing, and I try to be fair, but I'm just very annoyed by him and the whole thing. If anything, he should be punished for making people, thinking that people would believe that Trump supporters are walking around Streeterville with ropes. Like that, come on. Like, just in the dead of winter.
In a MAGA hat, didn't he say that?
In a MAGA hat. I know some police that were on the scene responding to it, and it's just a mess. Overall, though, Kate's right. I mean, a deal was made. It should be honored. He's gone through a lot already. And at this point, what is the overall long-term impact of what Jussie Smollett did to the city of Chicago? It's minimal. You know, it was annoying. It was a waste of police's time and a waste of police resources. But look, there's a lot of other things the police are doing that are a waste of police resources, too. So at the end of the day, I say give the man a break. Kate makes a good point. I think they actually may end up ruling in his favor.
Justice Halperin.
There's a benefit to making the whole thing go away. I'm not sure I agree, Brandon, that there was no harm otherwise, because it was in the middle of a very tense time in the country and in our city, and bringing in race issues, he put a noose around his neck and sat with it in the police station. Mm. It was just so ugly. It just stirred up a lot of hatred and ugly speech in the city at a time when we didn't need it. So there was some harm. But also, Kate, maybe you delved a little deeper into this than me, but I'll just look at what they wrote. So the appellate justices who said that it's not a solid deal, they say flatly, in their opinion, the record does not contain any evidence that prosecutors agreed Smollett would not be further prosecuted in exchange for forfeiting his bond and performing community service. It wasn't a good deal. I agree with you about that. It wasn't clear, but his lawyers knew it as well as prosecutors, so I wouldn't put all that onto Kim Fox. But then the dissenting justice, the appellate justice Lyle, says it was common sense that Smollett was bargaining for a complete resolution of the matter, not a temporary one. Well, laws and legal opinions are not based on common sense. There's nothing in the record. I think his lawyers failed to represent him properly in that deal. And if Kim Fox left a loophole, she might have wanted it for the follow-up that happened when Dan Webb did his investigation. So, sorry, not sorry is how I feel.
I do think what he did was extremely serious. It did really poison the discourse and obviously whipped up all kinds of bad feelings among so many people, and makes it more difficult, or did for some time, for true victims of hate crimes.
That's right.
Right? So it puts a big question mark over anybody claiming a hate crime when you have such an incredibly high profile instance as this. So I do think what he did was super serious, and I hate to see him get off, but I kind of think
he wasn't Justice Smollett, the famous guy. Would we even have this discussion?
The thing that's so interesting about this is that if Smollett had just pleaded guilty, he probably would not have been sentenced to any jail time, and he would have had to pay a fine, and his career would be back on track by now. I mean, there is the argument that just says, like, this guy, his name is a joke, his career is in the gutter, and he has paid a much, much, much higher price than anyone else who's filed a false police report, and just let the guy go and forget about it. Kim Fox is leaving office. I was surprised that she was reelected. I will thank Jussie Smollett for giving me material for about 15 Tribune columns. So he has paid his debt to me, that's for sure.
This is The Mincing Rascals, and there's one other area we want to get to. But first, let me get you to Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. Surrounded by open spaces, rivers, and trails, Ottawa's a natural setting that allows you to get outdoors and enjoy some fall relaxation. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms, established hotels, resorts, private rentals, B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, now back to The Mincing Rascals.
But let's wrap up by talking about the presidential race. What's been going on in Springfield, Ohio? What's the escalated rhetoric? Attempted assassination, another attempted assassination on Donald Trump. Marge, you brought this up in the Google Doc chat. Where are you these days on the presidential race?
Well, I'm the same place I've always been. Go Harris.
Well, yeah. I don't mean who you're going to vote for. But what do
you think? I've changed my mind. Have not.
Yeah, that's a red baseball hat on. Yeah.
No. So the Springfield, Ohio story is so disturbing on so many levels. It was so ugly. Earlier in this national discourse, go back to 2016 or whatever, those of us who were so strongly opposed to Trump and MAGA-ism were warned, don't talk about Nazis. That's too harsh. We can't go there. But look at what they're doing. They're taking pages out of the Nazi playbook. They're othering people. They're making hate crimes almost legit. And when J.D. Vance says, first of all, bring on the cat memes, I'm sorry that so many people in my social media feeds did it, because it wasn't funny and it accentuated and expanded the hate and bomb threats against Haitians and public officials who are not Haitian in Springfield, Ohio. So it created more hate. It poisoned the atmosphere. And then we have J.D. Vance say on CNN, well, I have to create stories if the media won't cover it. Okay. You know, Dana Bash's eyes get wide, her jaw kind of drops. Did you just say you created this story? Yes. And if that's what I have to do to get coverage, I'm going to do it. Yeah, saying the quiet part out loud has become Vance's signature, right? Even Trump knows not to complete a sentence like that, just to use a few words that give the implication, but don't say it. Vance's clumsy version of Trump in that sense. But he said it, and we heard it, and people in Ohio are suffering. I mean, there's still danger in New York because of that awful Pizzagate thing. You know, right? Wasn't it just a year and a half ago or so where something, somebody else stormed into that pizza restaurant thinking Hillary Clinton's baby killers are in the basement? Like, that stuff lingers. And the Haitians in Springfield, I think we all know now, are there legally. They were invited by Honda and other corporations that needed to fill jobs. They've pumped up the economy, which is what happens nationally. We have that Congressional Budget Office report from a year or so ago. It adds trillions of dollars to the national economy to have immigrants who come here and take the jobs. They're not taking away other people's jobs, black jobs, white jobs, Latino jobs, citizens' jobs. They're not taking jobs. They're taking jobs that people don't want. And that's what they were brought to Springfield, Ohio for, and it was successful. Now, children are in danger, the bomb threats, threat city council, they've shut down the college campuses. That kind of hate, and then admitting you created a story to generate that hate, what more do we need to know to understand that fascism is at work here, and it needs to be stopped at the ballot box, because it won't stop otherwise.
Okay, you've persuaded me. Brandon. Brandon, you're an Ohio guy. How close do you did you grow up to Springfield?
Not that far, actually. I moved around a lot in Ohio, from Cleveland to Cincinnati to the border of Ohio, Indiana, Richmond, Indiana. And Springfield's right there in the Miami Valley near Dayton. Know the area very well. I know Haitians. My mom, who suffered a stroke not too long ago, she's taken care of by a Haitian caretaker. So, like, I find it all so deeply unsettling, and I hope that most Americans find it deeply unsettling, and I think ultimately what I want to see, and I have a grim feeling it's not going to be what I want to see, but what I want to see is the response. The response has to come at the ballot box when there is such blatant racism put forward. This is not the first time that Donald Trump has used his playbook. It's not going to be the last time. It's completely unfair to those hardworking people. It's unfair to the community of Springfield, who are dealing with bomb threats, school being let out because of these threats, community festivals being canceled, all kinds of things. It's disrupting their way of life. And Ohio, at this point, leaning pretty heavy red nowadays. I'm curious now, does any of this move Ohio back to being a bellwether, maybe going back to purple-ish? But yeah, deeply unsettling. This has been so much in this campaign. And at this point, this mythical undecided voter, I'm wondering where they're sitting right now and why are they still undecided? There's two very clear choices here. The economy is obviously still a problem for many people. So that's definitely the biggest issue. But I change my mood on what's going to happen in this election almost every day. With situations like this, I would like to think, and from my coverage of elections in the past, I would really think stuff like this does not help the Trump campaign garner independence, build his coalition, or bring on undecided voters. It actually hurts. And so this election could be a blowout. It could be Kamala Harris winning resoundingly, or it could be people dismissing this as Trump being Trump. This is the way it always has been. It's normalized now, and it's going to be a close one. It's going to go either way, and I'm just fascinated to see what happens. But just seeing what's happening with the attack on the Haitian community there, It's disheartening.
Yeah, I wonder if this is something that's actually going to motivate a lot more Democratic voters to get out, that it is really so disturbing what's gone on there. And Vance's admission that he just makes up stuff because he wants the media to write what he wants them to write about certain issues. Kate, what are your thoughts about the presidential race these days?
I think it's going to stay really close, probably right down to the line, because I think things like this insanity with the lies they spread about the Haitian immigrants in Springfield, I think it will probably just get buried underneath the landslide of future lies that we have yet to hear. Yeah. So I don't know that this in itself will be one of the things that wins it for Kamala Harris if she wins, but it is just a further sign that Trump is his own worst enemy. Immigration is the number two concern of all the voters underneath the economy. And that's one of the things where he can get independent, undecided voters is on his either harder line stance against immigration or them believing more that he really will stop immigration you know, more than they think Kamala Harris would. And yet he manages to take even something that should be a campaign strength for him and turns it into something that could very well, yeah, absolutely hurt him by, you know, just showing his true colors, showing how extremely hateful and full of lies his campaign can be. But he did that over and over and over again in 2016, and it didn't matter. So we'll have to see whether or not it actually makes a difference in the long run. It's the whole situation, though, is I just have to throw in with everyone else. The whole situation is so sad. That country is obviously been in some of the worst turmoil of any other country in the entire hemisphere. And for the people who have had to flee from what's going on there, to have to put up with this in a place where they have come to for refuge and where they are just working hard and contributing to the community, it's just really infuriating.
Well, Trump has said that he is going to deport them to Venezuela. So we have that going.
Right. The Haitians? He's going to send the Haitians to Venezuela?
That's what he said.
Maybe a part that's probably not talked about enough. A lot of Trump's anti-immigration attacks are toward the Latino immigrants, right? However, he has attacked the Black immigrants as well. Remember the S-hole countries comment? And now you have this. And we're seeing, if you look at the latest Pew data, more and more of these children who were brought over from their parents, they're now reaching voting age, or they're millennials now, and they're first-generation Americans. They're first-generation Haitian Americans, right? And they're seeing stuff like this about their community. That can't possibly help Trump. And if anything, Kamala Harris, who, let's be frank here, she's going to get the Black vote, but she does not have the same stronghold of Black support that Barack Obama was able to get and Joe Biden was able to get. Something like this could help her, especially with Black men who she's losing. There was a poll from the NAACP last week that confirmed a lot of what I've been hearing and what I've been seeing, that 1 in 4 younger Black men are backing Donald Trump for president in this election. That's big. 63% of Black voters favor Harris compared to 13% backing Trump. It may not seem big in large context, but when you think about past elections and the Democratic Party and the stronghold of what these candidates need to win, Harris has a big hill to climb there still. And so things like this may animate the base a little bit more on Harris's side.
And I can answer partially the question you asked earlier, Brandon, about why are these people still, why is anyone still undecided? Because I'm still knocking doors in Michigan and working with folks who go to Wisconsin. And these low information voters is the phrase. Remember when Trump told his rally, you know, however many years ago, I love the undereducated. He meant it. That's why they're trying to destroy public schools, by the way, across the country, and why Project 2025 says they'll shut down the education department because they don't want people to be educated. That's also part of the old playbook. But when you talk to voters, well, I heard somebody on NPR last week, a young man who said the most important issue for him is reproductive rights. Then he went on to say, well, but because both candidates are about the same on that issue, I've had a hard time, but I'm leaning to Harris. Yeah, about the same as what he thought. I knocked on somebody's door in Benton Harbor, also a young man, who said, well, I vote Republican. And I said, really, what issues, you know, are stirring you to vote Republican this time? He said, well, no real issues. It's just history. I'm like, oh, your family. You've always voted Republican. That's right. We're all Republican. And I said, well, I am definitely on the Democrat side because of women's right to control their own body. And I give my little speech about that. And my granddaughters don't have the rights I had, etc. And then he said, oh, I'm pro-choice. Well, you have no business voting for Trump. Do you hear him brag about ending Roe v. Wade? Do you hear the debate over IVF? And, you know, he didn't know. Oh, I guess I better research that, he said. 10,000 voters like that in each swing state who might decide this election.
Well, that's Marge Halperin, and we're also joined by Kate Plies and Brandon Pope. I'm Eric Zorn. I've been sitting in for John Williams as the host of the Mincing Rascals. John, come back. We need you. And we will drop another podcast on you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.